Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza here in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Wednesday, April 9, 2014. Doctors Without Borders lashes out at the UN mission in South Sudan for not providing better care to thousands of South Sudanese living in its Juba camp.
The people continue to live there in the conditions that they have today. We have a really high possibility of an outbreak.
And political leaders toured the country explaining what happened in the lead-up to the fighting and asked for feedback on what to do next.
We are planning to go to all the counties and all the payams. It is our responsibility to come back to our respective constituencies and to give them the real story of what has happened in Juba.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. French medical charity Doctors Without Borders, or MSF, has criticized the United Nations mission in South Sudan for not doing more to improve the living conditions of internally displaced persons at Juba's stomping base. MSF officials accuse UNMISS of being indifferent to the plight of more than 21,000 IDPs who say they are living in contaminated flood waters. As Mungume Davis Rakarinj reports for VOA, UNMISS says they are doing everything they can to make things better at the UN base.
MSF officials say when the rainy season started last month, 150 latrines collapsed at Tomping. They say IDPs are living in natural drainage channels where feces from the collapsed toilets have mixed with flood waters, posing a severe health risk to the IDPs. MSF Emergency Coordinator Carolina Lopez warns that unless the UN moves in quickly to improve the camp's hygiene, the IDPs are at risk of catching waterborne diseases, which could trigger an epidemic.
And the people continue to live there in the conditions that they have today. We have a really high possibility of an outbreak, okay? In any case, it's clear that the diarrheal disease will increase, respiratory tract infections will increase as well, skin infections will increase as well. All of these will increase, and apart from that, we can really have an outbreak.
Lopez says MSF receives at least 200 patients daily suffering from waterborne diseases. While admitting that the IDPs live in deplorable conditions, UNMISS spokesperson Ariane Quintier says her organization is at its best to improve living conditions at the base.
I believe that we all agree that things should be done immediately, and we are doing things. What we are doing immediately as I am talking to you is two things. On one hand, we are relocating civilians who do live in very unhealthy conditions. We are relocating them to another area. This has been happening this 12th of March. So far, we've managed to relocate almost 1,500 civilians.
Lopez says plans to establish an alternative site for IDPs is now unrealistic because of the onset of rains. Heavy rains are expected to last for the next 6 months, something MSF says will likely exacerbate already deplorable conditions at Tomping Base. Lopez says the overcrowding and insufficient sanitation facilities at the camp are unacceptable.
Today we have 65 people per one latrine. Normally it should be 20 persons by one latrine, okay? And I think after more than 3 months in this camp, it should be done, okay? And it's not. And latrines are collapsing during the rainy season.
Last week, Hilda Johnson, the head of UNMISS, told reporters in Juba that the UNMISS camp is at an imminent risk of turning into a death trap. And Lopez agrees, adding the situation in Juba is the most visible example of the widespread unmet humanitarian needs in South Sudan. For VOA News, I am Mugume Davis Rakarinj in Juba.
The Jonglei State Assembly leadership is getting an overhaul. The state's top two leaders have resigned, saying they agreed to a power-sharing deal that would geographically distribute the state's top political positions more evenly among the communities. Philip Aleu has the story for VOA.
Peter Cholwal, who has served as State Assembly Speaker since 2009, says the party has decided to uphold an unwritten rule that the state top four positions should be shared between Jonglei State four geographic areas: Greater Pibor, Greater Kobo, Greater Bor, and Greater Pangak, both Wal and Kete Governor John Kung-Nguon, who was appointed in November, come from Greater Pangak. Wal says it was important to maintain the power-sharing deal so all parts of the state felt they were being equally represented. The arrangement was created so power would be balanced between all the state's ethnic groups. The four top positions are governor, deputy governor, speaker, and deputy speaker. Nguon was appointed after former governor Kwal Manyang Juk was elevated to national defense minister. Wal announced he was stepping down from his position as speaker in the state assembly yesterday.
The issue of balancing and power sharing according to the great press, they are not written in our legal document. But because of respect to my party and leadership of this state, I can assure you that I have resigned from my position as a speaker of the Jumuli State in the legal department. And I shall also continue supporting the leadership of the assembly, new leadership of the assembly, as well as the leadership of our state. Thank you very much.
Wal will remain a member of the assembly, but is being replaced by Deng Agwer, who comes from the Greater Bor area. Deputy Speaker Brutus Oshala from Greater Pibor also stepped down this week after the Nguon appointed a new deputy governor, Baba Medan, who also hails from that area. Former deputy governor Hussein Mar has joined Deng Machar's opposition team. Medan was sworn in last week. Nguon praised the politician who resigned their positions as true patriots who he says value peace.
I want to appreciate Comrade Chol Wal for the bravery and commitment to the party and his concern about the unity of the people of Jonglei State. He did not take his personal interest as his number one concern.
The new speaker and deputy speaker were sworn in this morning. For BOA News, I am Philip Aleu.
National lawmakers are traveling the country this month, explaining to people their version of events of what led up to fighting, which led to at least 10,000 deaths, according to human rights groups. They are also asking for feedback on how they can help improve the relations in the country. A 15-person mobilization team arrived this week in Western Bahr al-Ghazal. Michael Atit reports on their visit for VOA from WOW.
Mark Nyipoch Obang, the Deputy Speaker of the National Assembly, leads the group to Western Bahr al-Ghazal. He is from the state's Jiu River County. He says it is important that the government explain to its citizens why the fighting started and why they are doing to bring it to a close.
We are planning to go to all the counties and all the payams. It is our responsibility to come back to our respective constituencies and to give them the real story of what has happened in Juba. We have to explain the bitterness and the fighting that our country has gone through and to hear what kind of problems the citizens are facing.
Obang says they will take citizen concerns back to Juba and talk to the government officials about the situation in the ground. He says he hopes the mobilization will bring results and convince most residents that the government is working in their interest. Flora Simon Ugali came to a meeting in WOW to tell Obang and the other team members that she worries about the future for her three children. She says she wants to make sure they have jobs and opportunities and hopes the mobilization effort is the first step in improving the situation in South Sudan.
I expect good things to come from the previous period. Women and children have suffered, so there needs to be some practical changes. The mobilization is bringing hope that the government wants to listen to us and will make changes.
Abdallah Jibril, a local businessman, says this campaign has come too late. He says the situation in the country was bad before the fighting began, and the government should have started consulting the people long before December.
It is supposed to take place earlier, even before the crisis. It should not be done just because of the war in the country. It is a good thing to give a positive image of the army and its leaders.
Similar teams are meeting with the communities in all 10 states this month. Obang says they will share their experiences with the entire country after they return to Juba by the end of this month. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Wau.
Last week, Sudan's President Omar al-Bashir called for a national dialogue with opposition activists to end the violence in southern Kordofan, Blue Nile states, and Darfur. Farouk Abu Issa, the leader of opposition alliance in Sudan, says his side has accepted President's call for dialogue. Abu Issa tells VOA fellow May Abdel Nasser the opposition wants Sudan to change into a new style of government where the issues of democracy, constitutional reform, and economic stability are incorporated.
We gave our initial agreement to engage in this dialogue side by side with armed groups as long as it will result in a solution to Sudan's crisis and in a transition from this one-party regime to a multi-party system through election and the rule of law. We are not just for any dialogue, we are for a fruitful dialogue. Our people are in a real crisis in all aspects of their life, be it economic or security-wise. We have a war going on in Sudan. So we need a dialogue that will end the current regime and correct the situation. But first, we must create the conducive environment for that kind of dialogue to take place by guaranteeing political freedom and abolishing the laws that restrict it.
That was Farouk Abu Issa, the leader of Sudan's opposition alliance, speaking to May Abdel Nasser earlier today from Khartoum. Sudan has already begun talking with the opposition parties about the transition of their regime into democratic style of government, according to top NCP senior official. NCP party spokesman Rabi Abdelati says Sudanese government is guaranteeing political freedom to all political parties. Abdelati tells VOA fellow Nabil Biajo that this government will implement the results of the talks without making any amendment to the recommendations.
The outcome of gathering, which was held on Sunday, the different factions and different political parties, they have all agreed upon a mechanism of dialogue about different issues that already presented by President al-Bashir. And this mechanism will also continue.
One particular concern that's shared among all political forces in Sudan is political freedom. So what are the concrete steps that the government is taking to show its will to walk the talk about political freedom?
From the very beginning, President al-Bashir, on the opening session, and according to her address to all gathering on Sunday, he declared that freedom of different political parties will be allowed, and also he declared that political people who arrested during the past the past will be set free, and for the intelligence department last night, they already declared that all the detainees set free, and especially the detainees who detained due to political reasons.
And President Bashir has opened his arms even to armed rebels to engage in the peace talks.
Yes,
how is the government?
He said that for the armed forces. We will guarantee for them that they can come and participate in the talks and dialogue, and also to guarantee for them at any time to go out if they want to go, if there is no agreement with them. And this is frankly declared by our president in that gathering what held on Sunday.
The opposition parties have always been calling for the dissolution of the current government in favor of an inclusive transitional government. Does that sound like something your government might consider?
Actually, for the issue of discussion. The issue of discussion is to come and to exchange opinions about the suitable government which will govern the country up to the time of election, which will be at the end of the year 2014 and beginning of the year 2015. And it is premature to say what will be agreed upon, because this will be a subject of discussion between different political parties.
That was Rabih Abdelhatti, a spokesperson for the National Congress Party in Sudan, speaking to VOA fellow Nabil Biagio earlier today from Khartoum.
This is a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.
Staying healthy is important to everyone, but it is particularly important if you're a woman expecting a baby. Women should get competent medical care as soon as they realize they're pregnant, and they should follow these general guidelines to increase the chances of having a healthy baby. Eat a variety of good foods with nutrients, including fruits and vegetables. Wash your hands and wash your food before preparing it. Also, wash your hands right before eating. Don't drink alcohol or smoke. Avoid pesticides, paint, or strong chemical cleaners. And decrease or eliminate coffee or tea. All these things can improve the chances of having a healthy baby.
That was a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, the upcoming election in South Africa have generated a lot of interest among the unemployed. Stay tuned.
For all the latest in-depth news and analysis on events in South Sudan, tune in to Voice of America's South Sudan in Focus, Monday through Friday from 1630 to 1700 UTC. You can email us at southsudan@voanews.com. We are also on the web at voanews.com/South Sudan. Or download our podcast on iTunes. That's South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
how should foreigners be treated in your country?
The foreigners should not be treated wrongly, in a sense that their rights should not be opposed. When a foreigner has a right in that particular country, he has to be given his right. Not to say you are not a citizen of this country, you should be mistreated or you should be done what?
It doesn't matter whether he's a white or black, but the fact remains that this, once a person come to visit your country, this is like a visitor, he's like a brother. So we have to treat each other equally.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus. The World Health Organization is issuing its first ever global guidelines on treating hepatitis C, a liver disease that kills between 350 to 500,000 people every year. WHO says the guidelines will reduce deaths from hepatitis C by helping countries improve the treatment. Lisa Schlein reports from WHO headquarters in Geneva.
The World Health Organization says between 130 and 150 million people globally have chronic hepatitis C infection. The most affected regions are Central and East Asia and North Africa. The hepatitis C virus is mainly spread through exposure to contaminated blood. This can happen through unsafe healthcare practices involving the reuse of needles and syringes. A significant number of people who are chronically infected with hepatitis C will develop liver cirrhosis or liver cancer. WHO is publishing its guidelines as more effective and safer oral hepatitis medicines become more readily available on the market. Stefan Wichter, head of WHO's Global Hepatitis Program, says hepatitis C can be treated and cured, and he says treatments are getting better all the time.
Up until recently, to treat somebody with hepatitis C was required approximately 48 weeks of weekly injections of medicine called interferon, which was very toxic, very difficult to take and really discourage people from taking the medicine. Now the newer treatments are much shorter, 12 weeks. Some of them are treated without any injections at all and result in more than 90% cure rates.
Unfortunately, Dr. Wichter says most people in the world do not receive treatment for this illness. This is largely due to the lack of awareness of the problem and the lack of healthcare workers trained to recognize and deal with the disease. However, he notes the biggest problem is that most people do not have any symptoms. Therefore, they do not know they may be at risk and should be tested. He says the infection too often remains undiagnosed until serious liver damage has developed. Another major problem is hepatitis C treatment is unaffordable for most patients. Dr. Wichter says the newer drugs can cost as much as $84,000 for a 12-week course of treatment. He acknowledges price is a huge challenge to overcome.
To bridge that gap between the promise of these new medicines and sort of the reality of low coverage, we are issuing, WHO developed its first ever treatment guidelines. And these guidelines, since they come with the WHO seal of approval and are strongly evidence-based, we feel will be an important tool for decision-makers in countries who are considering starting or scaling up hepatitis treatment programs to give them the recommendations that they can use to help guide the development of that program. Similarly, they can help healthcare workers in how to manage patients.
The new guidelines provide recommendations on screening for hepatitis C infection, on medical care to slow the progress of the disease, and on safe and effective treatments to cure chronic hepatitis C infection. They also suggest measures that can be taken to prevent the transmission of the hepatitis C virus. These include instructions on safe medical procedures regarding injections in a healthcare setting and among people who inject drugs. WHO officials say they are sure the price of treatment will come down dramatically as more people use and benefit from the new drugs. They note that treatment for HIV/AIDS used to cost $10,000 when it was first introduced. They say the same and better drugs now cost $100. WHO says competition from generic HIV drug manufacturers, mainly in India, and the huge expansion of the market for these drugs has driven down prices, making it much cheaper for governments to scale up treatment. It says it expects a similar downward spiral in the price of hepatitis C drugs to occur. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
South Africa is set to hold national elections on the 7th of May. In a country with more than 25% of unemployment, the elections have generated a lot of interest among jobless young people, most of whom will be voting for the first time since the country established full democracy in 1994. Tuso Khumalo speaks to young and first-time voters about their excitement and their hopes for change, and files for VOA from Johannesburg.
South African elections come 20 years after the nation shared the oppressive apartheid regime. The May 7th vote is also a coming of age for South Africa's so-called born-free generation, born just after 1994. This is their first chance at the national polls, and many say they are eager to participate. The nation's Electoral Commission says nearly half of the 25 million registered voters are younger than 40. And so, election campaigns have reached out to the needs of young voters. The ruling African National Congress, ANC, has promised to create 6 million jobs if given another mandate to rule. The Opposition Democratic Alliance, DA, has made a similar offer and questioned the ANC's promise and job creation plans. And the Young, Centered and Populist Economic Freedom Fighters, EFF, a new party that is contesting elections for the first time, has promised to nationalize mines and expropriate land without compensation to ensure that unemployed youths own the means of production. The harsh realities of South Africa's poverty and inequalities have long caused young voters to be disinterested in the country's politics. But the high unemployment rate and an increasing number of high-level corruption scandals seem to be encouraging more young people to use their vote to change the status quo. 22-year-old Daniel Pumuzo Magidi says he will not miss this year's vote for anything.
My vote will make a change because I believe that as young people of South Africa, we are the active generation, you know what I mean? Because we voice our things through the social networks and platforms that allow for the government to hear us and they can respond to us, apart from burning tires and all that. So yeah, I believe that my vote will have a say.
Ayanda Gumbi, 23, says she's disappointed with the ruling ANC for what she says is the party's failure to deal with corruption and unemployment. She says she's voting for the EFF, which is led by expelled ANC Youth League leader Julius Malema, who has been convicted of tax fraud and is also under investigation for corruption.
EFF Malema. I just like the guy. He's honest, he's truthful. People have been voting for ANC for years and years, but there's no change. So I think Malema is the guy to bring change.
Sugiswa Tubeni, 22, is thrilled to be voting for the first time, but says new parties like the EFF cannot be trusted.
I am excited because it's something that I have never done before. I believe in ANC, even though Jacob Zuma have his faults, but I know that ANC one day will make up something.
And other young voters like Nomvula Ndebele say they are still undecided.
We've got Julius Malema telling us we're going to get free education, free houses, because the ANC has not been delivering. But we've got the DA also telling us that we're going to be getting this and this. So it's a bit complicated for now.
Prince Mashele, executive director at the Pretoria-based Center for Politics and Research, says only around 30% of eligible new voters are registered this year. But of those, he thinks the majority are likely to vote against the ANC, a sign the party is losing its 20-year dominance.
The age group between, say, 23 and 30, I think that group is more likely to go with Malema because most of them have never worked, by the way, in their lives. They had hoped that the ANC would change their economic lot, but the ANC has failed to do so.
20 years ago, many of these voters' parents watched as this nation transformed quickly from oppression to freedom. This year, more than a million first-time South African voters will get to experience that freedom at the polling booth. Tuso Kumalo for VOA News, Johannesburg.
And that brings us to the end of our show for this Wednesday. We now leave you with the song South Sudan Independence by Dynamic.
Umon kan gali ina mark there kedai no asa ina ligo independence isin tai dynamic wele talo tuko de apuma de belete na South Sudan ligo independence dunia kulu gali ina nasigo wikalis. Minjubale turiti na badaguna woyoi. Mashakin futu, belete na jedi.
Independence,
belete na ligo. Belete na ligo.
Independence,
belete na ligo. Belete na ligo.
Independence,
belete na ligo. South Sudan ligo. Belete na ligo. Gebila taki, gebila tani ikulu sawa. Motoro kanenzil,
malinezil vipetuwa.
Jojojojo, mina kulu wakulu minsa hanwahi. Sipu tatani, leyalte inda depi South Sudan. Wajaya, belete na ligo. Belete na ligo. Belete na ligo.
Independence
ligo. Belete na ligo. Belete na ligo. Waya ya ya ya. Umataki. Oh la 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 la. Abutaki.
We have been listening to Dynamic with that song about South Sudan's independence. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for listening and join us again tomorrow for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.